Hi, friends. Welcome to Bayou de Beltway. I'm your host, Pearson Cross. Today we are joined by the Secretary of the Department of Children and Family Services, Marquita Garner-Walters, to talk about children and families and how they're doing in Louisiana. Secretary Walters was born in Alabama in Tuscaloosa, attended college at U Alabama before finishing at Southern Miss with a degree in therapeutic recreation. She then worked in nonprofits for a while, including the American Heart Association, before becoming Governor Blanco's assistant secretary of what was then DSS. During the general years, she went to Washington, where she served as research director on some federally funded projects. And then she came back to Louisiana, although she probably never left, at least in heart, and took over as director of the agency she had been at previously, the Department of Children and Family Services. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. For those people who may not be familiar with what your department does and how it functions, could you just clear that up for us a little bit? So tell us about the department and its activities and what you're responsible for.
Sure. There are three big parts of what we do. We do child welfare, which includes child abuse investigations, foster care, adoption, all of the pieces and parts that go into that. Then we have the family support side of the house, as I call it, and that is the eligibility programs where we have food stamps, child support enforcement. So we have child support, food stamps, or the SNAP program. And we run all the TANF programs, and people may know those by the kinds of TANF is a bucket of money from the feds, and it funds numerous programs. In Louisiana, it helps fund our four-year-old kindergarten program and some smaller programs like the JAG, Jobs for America's Graduates, and Nurse Family Partnership, and some other things. And then we have a big body of work in the emergency preparedness work. People really don't know that about us, but every department has an emergency support function, and ours happens to be mass care and sheltering. So it's a big chunk of work during a disaster. And also on the family support side, we have disability determinations. That's a 100% federally funded program, but it resides inside of our department.
Good grief, that sounds like a lot.
It feels like a lot some days.
Yeah, I want to talk about emergency preparedness a little. Just let's do that initially. Emergency preparedness and mass care and sheltering. Mm-hmm. So when there is a hurricane and people don't have housing or those sorts of things, mm-hmm. Your agency springs into action.
Yes, we do. We start springing into action before most people are even buying their batteries and putting up getting the wood to cover their windows. So we are at the Governor's Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness called GOSEP, and then we have our own Emergency Operations Center within our building downtown, our office building downtown.
I hope it's off the first floor.
It is actually on the first floor.
Oh, no.
But it's a little raised. We're a little raised. So we have people that cover every part of what we do in the agency that are manning those stations, and we're right in the heart of everything. So basically, for sheltering, the front line is with the local parish. So the first order of defense is your parish shelter. And when the parish gets to a point where it feels it's overrun or out of capacity or needs any kind of help, that's when we come in. And when there is a medical special need shelter, so for people that are fragile and have trouble evacuating, we run those shelters. And when I say we run them, that's the DCFS staff stop their normal job and move into emergency preparedness mode. And we go into a critical incident structure. And so your boss might be somebody you supervise in the emergency functions. At that point, we follow that command structure and not our normal hierarchy. And so we actually put the cots out, put the blankets and pillows on the cots, greet people as they come in, get them registered, help them find a safe, dry, warm space, make sure that they are fed, and create play areas for the children so that they can have some relief and have some sense of normalcy, because a shelter is not a normal environment. all of that work is DCFS employees doing that. And so those are called the state-run shelters. And they're shelters that people don't have their own transportation to and from. So if you can go to a shelter that's at a church, that you can drive your car up and you can stay there and you can leave when you're ready, that's not operated by our staff. Our staff you would normally see more in the big convention centers or the hall here on campus that might be converted to an emergency shelter.
Now, you have, I think, with your agency, about 3,500 employees mm-hmm. approximately. So those are the people that are pressed into action
yes.
during these emergencies, okay?
During the 2016 mm-hmm. floods, two-thirds of our staff left their normal duty and were on emergency preparedness duty.
Now, how quickly do parishes get overwhelmed? Does it depend vary parish to parish?
It varies parish to parish and the severity of the weather. Every parish has its own emergency operations center and process, and they have people that spring into action just like we do. And so it usually takes a lot for a parish to get to that place, but certainly on a scope of a big hurricane or like the floods that we had in August of 16. And then actually for Harvey, when Hurricane Harvey hit Texas and, you know, our southwest corner, we sheltered Harvey residents in Alexandria for, it felt like quite a while. I think it was only about a week and a half, but we sheltered them and took care of them because we could rescue, we could get to the southeast part of Texas from our southwest corner where Texas could not get down because of the flooding and the road, so we could rescue their people quicker than they could get to their people.
Interesting.
So we were doing that down in Lake Charles and then taking them up to a big shelter in Alexandria.
Well, you know, you think about a week and a half, which isn't very long, but I believe if I was staying in a shelter, it would feel like an eternity.
It does feel
it
like
really,
a much
wow,
longer
that's,
time. And then after the disaster is over and things are beginning to get to normal, we do the disaster food stamp program. And so that
it's in addition to SNAP.
Yes.
It's disaster. It's run out of the same kind of program.
It's the exact same thing.
And it's federally funded.
It's federally funded. So mm-hmm. all the money that somebody gets when they're getting a disaster food stamp card, mm-hmm. And they get a card that looks like a credit card. There's no cash. There was a big misconception about that in 2016. People thought we were giving away cash and there's no money involved. But we that's a big deal and takes a lot of staff because we don't want people waiting in long lines. So we try to really ramp up and have a big operation where we can get to people quickly.
So this is, from an organizational standpoint, a nightmare, quite frankly, what you're describing here.
But it's so well run and so well organized, it doesn't feel like a nightmare internally.
Well, that's great,
yeah.
And that's a testament to its efficiency or unsung efficiency. But I'm just thinking from the standpoint of, you know, we have roughly, you know, not 3,500 employees here, but mm-hmm. we have, you know, 2,500 or something mm-hmm. like that. And I can imagine that if all of a sudden everybody at UL or most mm-hmm. people at UL all of a sudden had to drop entirely what they're yeah. doing and take up in new jobs and new right. areas and new you know, new lines of responsibility. I mean, that seems daunting, to be quite frank.
It is daunting, oh, and it really does require a lot of our staff, and they're just amazing and how well they do that. Unfortunately, we have a lot of practice because we're that kind of hurricane state.
Yeah,
and
I was
so
wondering,
do you ever
wish you were the in Iowa, you know, whatever happens. And, oh, we had a lot of snow, maybe. I don't know what it would be.
I don't know, but I love it here.
Somewhere
so
away from
okay.
the Mississippi River and yeah. the Gulf, and then, you know. Oh, you're the chief agency in Louisiana responsible for children and families. How are children and families in Louisiana doing, generally speaking?
That depends on which part of the population you're talking about. For mm-hmm. the largest part of our state, I think we're doing really well. You know, employment has gone up under this governor. We've seen a lot of economic development coming into this state with John Bell. And so I think that our state is doing really well. most people in the state never know who the Department of Children and Family Services is, because you only come to us when you're in crisis. Mm-hmm. So we are truly an emergency response organization, whether it's typically a woman who can't get child support and needs help doing that process, or somebody that has food insufficiency now that maybe has never dealt with anything like that. Thinking of just this area, the Lafayette area, when the oil crisis hit here, mm-hmm. all of a sudden you had a lot of really highly trained and skilled professional people that were out of jobs and were eligible for food stamps. So that body went up in this segment of our state during that time. Mm-hmm. And then as they found other employment and other things came into play, they dropped off the program because they didn't need it anymore. So we see swells like that in the SNAP program, depending on the economy and where things are good or where there are plenty of jobs or where people are struggling.
Well, since you brought it up, let's talk about SNAP a little bit. You know, it's in the news all the time mm-hmm. because I don't know what it is about SNAP program, but a lot of people seem to feel like, oh, we're just giving away stuff to people who don't need it. And the dollar amounts are pretty huge. Looking at your own figures, mm-hmm. You hand out, or the feds hand out $108 million monthly. So that boils down to about $1.2 billion a year in SNAP benefits. So that's an enormous amount of money. And in fact, one in six or one mm-hmm. in five Louisiana residents gets SNAP benefits. So this is an enormous program. Tell mm-hmm. us how it works and who gets it, and are people who are getting it freeloaders?
That's a great question, and the short answer is no. There is such a misconception about this program. It is a lot of money, and there are a lot of people on it. The largest number of people on the program are children and disabled people and senior citizens. So if you take that combination, that's about 65% of the people on the program are either under 18, over 65, or disabled, or a combination of elderly and disabled. So that leaves the chunk of people in the middle that would be what you would call somebody that ought to be able to go get a job. Those people are usually the working poor. There are so many of our citizens that work really hard and may work two jobs and still don't quite make ends meet. And the other thing is, let's talk about how much money a family can get. A single person in Louisiana is getting about $120 a month for food. Think about that, $120 a month. If you think about going out to eat, even if you just go get a burger and fries, you're spending $5 to $7. How long is $120 going to last for you? So even if you're a family of four or five and you're getting $400, that doesn't feed a family for a month. That's why it's called supplemental nutrition. It's not designed to feed you for the whole month. It's designed to help you augment. So most of the people on this program are either the working poor or they're elderly, disabled, or children. And so my contention when people say, oh, they're just freeloaders on this program, is first of all, they're misinformed, because that's not accurate. And second of all, who out of that group would you take food away from? Who would you say isn't worthy? And then I think people have a better understanding. And when they understand how much or how little, depending you look at it, somebody actually gets, it usually changes their mind.
We're about to come to break, okay. But I want to ask a quick question. So it's $120 a month for an individual mm-hmm. and for, say, a family of four, that goes up to, they're graduated,
yes,
but it steps up,
yes.
So you may be okay. We are talking today with Secretary of the Department of Children and Family Services, Marquita Garner-Walters, and we're going to talk some more when we come back right after these messages.
Have you ever heard a story that changed the way you saw the world?
I had witnessed the terrifying joy of unbearable responsibility.
We fight for identity, sometimes we kill for identity, but why is that?
I can't let my life be this, because if I give up right now, that's what my life will be.
I'm Guy Raz. Join me each week for inspiring stories on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Coming up tonight at 8 on KRVS.
Under music director Riccardo Muti, the Chicago Symphony Orchestra continues to be one of the finest orchestras in the world. I'm Lisa Simeone, and I hope you'll join me as we hear the CSO charge into the 21st century with repertoire both new and old, taking listeners behind the scenes and into the music. That's right here with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra.
Coming up Monday night at 9, here on KRVS.
Hi, friends. I'm Pearson Cross. Welcome back to Bayou de Beltway. I'm chatting today with the Secretary of the Department of Children and Family Services, Marquita Garner-Walters. When we left and we were talking about SNAP benefits mm-hmm. and whether they were kind of given to people who mm-hmm. needed them or were they exploited, and you said that actually a lot of SNAP benefits or of the 35% group that is not either children, disabled, or senior mm-hmm. are given to people who are the working poor. There's been a lot of talk lately, and I know once again the governor would like to raise the minimum wage mm-hmm. in Louisiana. What is your opinion? Do you think that raising the minimum wage would help these people who are working poor and maybe collecting SNAP benefits?
Absolutely. We know that a family can't live on the minimum wage, and even with the state assistance and food, that's still not a livable, affordable wage. And we just don't want people to have a bare bones. We want people to be able to thrive and for families to be able to do everything that they want to do and be able to feed their kids in healthy ways and send them to school well-fed and well-nourished. And so raising the minimum wage is a really good step toward that.
Have there been cuts to the SNAP program, to the food stamp program, as it's known popularly?
It seems like every year we get threatened with that cut, and we're under that threat again right now. Under the current proposed budget for next year that would start July 1, the Department of Children and Family Services has to take about a $13 million cut. The only place we can take a cut that substantial is in the SNAP program. You can't cut around the edges and cut a little here and cut a little there anymore in our department. That might have been true at one time. It might be true for most departments as you think, okay, we've got an X percent cut. We'll do a little here, a little there, a little here. But DCFS has been cut to the bones, and I like to say we're actually in bone marrow now. There is no fat to trim. There's no place we can cut out a little bit of this program. So we would have to cut an entire program to reach that level of state general fund investment of $13 million.
Let me ask this question now. SNAP itself is funded mostly by the federal government, but there's some state monies that are in there as well. And so so if the state quits participating in the SNAP program, then we lose the federal dollars too. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And you lose that $1.2 billion that's coming into our economy. Mm-hmm. And that comes in through local grocery stores. And so you just think about the ripple effect of the grocery stores and then the truckers and then the farmers mm-hmm. and all the way down that ripples through our economy, notwithstanding the people that would lose food substance. And so I don't really believe that cut will come to fruition. It never has in the past. I don't think anybody in our state really wants to cut that program. And so I believe that we'll find solutions to this and that we'll be okay.
You obviously haven't been listening to Lance Harris lately, but, you know. But in any case, why don't we kind of switch gears okay. and talk a little bit about something that kind of shocked me when I looked mm-hmm. at your figures. In 2018, your department answered 52,867 mm-hmm. calls of child abuse or neglect.
Yes.
I was kind of shocked.
It is shocking. I think most people have no earthly idea.
52,000 calls.
And those calls are often, some of them are repeat calls on the same case. Some of them are really more curiosity than a report. Somebody's trying to figure out what really is child abuse, what should I report? I saw something I don't understand. Maybe I need to talk to somebody. So a certain percentage of mm-hmm. those you can just discount as they don't even come near what you would call a level of reporting. But about half of them do. And so those are the reports that we then go out and investigate. And when I say the calls come in, we staff a crisis line, a hotline that is the child abuse reporting line, that is our staff on the phone 24 hours a day answering calls and walking the caller, who is the reporter of the abuse, through a series of questions, getting information, finding out how urgent the need is. Is the child in a safe place right now? Is this something urgent that the child's in great danger that we need to respond to immediately and need to call the police to go with us? Is this something that you're just suspecting and you want us to investigate, but there's no grand urgency that the child is in immediate danger? And so all of that is happening in that very first phone call into that centralized intake. And then that goes out to the investigator in each region, because that's a centralized hotline, so that you get seasoned, well-trained investigators that are answering the same kind of, using the same skills to walk through every call, so that a report in North Louisiana is treated the same as a report in South Louisiana. And then that call is filtered out to be investigated in the local area in which the complaint, you know, where the child is. And it goes from there.
Okay. I had a few questions while you were talking. Is there the reporting line, is that a 225 number or an 800 number, or do you know offhand, is this the number that most people call? It's not the 211 number.
Yeah, it's the 855-4-LA-KIDS.
855-4-LA-KIDS. Yeah. Okay. 855-4-LA-KIDS. And looking at the numbers for the Lafayette regional area, there were total reports of about 6,700 cases reported of, or these kind of inquiries that you're talking about. And of those, about 33 to 35% were actually source of investigation. What don't people under? Who makes these calls? Who calls it in? So it's just people who, is it spouses? Is it people who are observers?
The main three categories, the main three categories of reporters are law enforcement, school teachers, and the medical profession at large. So nurses, doctors, dentists.
And they get training to spot those sorts of things,
they
right?
They do.
What do you look for? Let's say you're a school teacher. What do you look for in terms of?
You look for changes in behavior that don't seem explained. Maybe a child's dressed inappropriately. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're coming to school in summer clothes in the winter, or vice versa. Mm-hmm. Or maybe a very outgoing, gregarious child suddenly gets very quiet and secretive. Or maybe the child starts acting in a different way. Maybe they start using sexual language, or they start touching another child, or they start using inappropriate comments. And so then you know that the child has something you suspect. You may not know. You suspect something is going on in that home. And so you could call the hotline and say, I'm a teacher, and this is what I'm seeing in this child.
Right. Yeah, when we first started talking about child abuse, which, of course, is a very tough topic, I was thinking about, you know, people who beat their kids or don't feed them or any, but there's also sex abuse as well. It's sadly an added element. Just in case you just tuned in, we're talking to the Secretary of the Department of Children and Family Services, Marquita Garner-Walters, today. So you have 3,500 employees in your department. How many of those are involved with pursuing these investigations? And is that a certain number per parish? Is that the way it breaks out? Or a certain number for regional?
So we have about 1,600 employees in the child welfare side of the house, if you will. And so that's broken down. There are a lot of those people working in foster care, caring foster care cases. There are a lot of those people doing adoption. And then there are people that do just centralized intake, and then people that do the child abuse investigation. Mm-hmm. So the numbers are roughly mirroring the population of each region. Mm-hmm. So in larger regions, you have more staff. In smaller regions, you have less staff. And then inside the region, there are multiple parishes. And so they're divvied out kind of the way they're needed.
I would think turnover would be a problem in that field just because people would get ground down from the cases and the tragedies they see.
Turnover is a tough thing for us to deal with. We do lose a lot of staff. We're doing better at recruiting people and being very candid about the kind of work. And a lot of it is in the support. When you're carrying, and right now our staff is carrying higher caseloads than the caseload standard, and we know that we're damaging people and we're not giving them all the help that they need and the support that they need, both our staff and our kids. And so we are working really hard trying to beef that up, and that takes money. And that takes the legislature investing in an agency that they have disinvested in for almost a decade.
Despite family-friendly rhetoric.
Yes.
You know, that's one of the things, like when the legislature is looking around for places to cut and they talk about, you know, children and family services. And I'm thinking, really? So you want to investigate fewer cases of child abuse? You want to, you know, it's just like crazy to me. Well, let's talk about the legislature. I usually say nasty things about them, so let's go ahead. I understand you're watching a couple of bills. What's up in this current legislative
session? We have two big bills that we're watching. One is raising the age of foster care from 18 to 21 for all youth in foster care. And another is a human trafficking bill of trying to build. Louisiana doesn't have a human trafficking policy or program. And so this bill, carried by Senator Ronnie Johns, is a start to that. The Regina Barrow bill, which is the author of the Raising the Age bill, is adding to what Senator Ryan Gatty did last year of raising the age for kids that were in high school.
So they can stay with their families.
Right.
Yeah. And it would raise it to 21.
To 21 for all youth in foster care.
Kids.
And the exciting part about it is it has a comeback clause. So if you get out there, you're sick of us, you want to run away, you get out, and you think, this is a little tougher than I thought it would be, we will take you back and help you through that process.
Yeah. Well, one thing about your agency that is so wonderful is you are really walking the walk when it comes to child welfare, as far as I can tell. And it's others may talk the talk, but you're the point where the rubber hits the road, so to speak.
And,
you know, so you see that, and I certainly applaud the efforts that you're making in this area. We've been talking today to the Secretary of the Department of Children and Families, Marquita Garner Walters. Thanks so much for coming to our show and educating us.
Thank you so much for asking me. It's been a delight.
Bayou to Beltway is copyrighted by KRVS for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without written consent of KRVS is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRVS, its officers, or members. To listen to a podcast of the interview we just heard, go to krvs.org.
Hi, this is Dan Phillips. Come on and funkify your life with my weekly mix of vintage and contemporary funk and rare groove music from New Orleans, elsewhere around the Gulf Coast and beyond. Thursdays at 1 p.m. and Friday nights at 9, Funkify Your Life on KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, and online at krvs.org.